You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week we design new decks for tournament play. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the Brew Session, Hinata Dawncrown is making waves in Standard and has already notched us a 5-0 trophy. We've got four brews for the Kirin King in Modern and Pioneer. Then on the flashback, testing results with Temeshi, Reality Architect. That's all coming up on this edition of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Welcome to the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Schriever, also known as Cave Dan Online. And I'm joined for our Sunday brew session by the one and only, the lovely Emmy Sagasti. It's Mord to Light. Welcome.
Thanks, Dan. Hello. How's it going? How is your day so far at this beautiful time of the day?
Yeah, this is an early morning Faithless Brewing. This is, as much as I like the sort of coffee theme of brewing, I'm not ready. I'm not awake for this. This is an ungodly hour for me.
You guys should notice and disappoint yourself in the fact that even if the dragon is holding a coffee cup, we never record in the morning.
Yeah.
We're just too lazy for that. There's no chance we're holding a cup of coffee. Maybe if it fits with whiskey, but not regular.
By ungodly hour, I mean like 8 a.m. I can't do 8 a.m.
This is the first time I'm happy I'm 2 hours later than you because it's 10 a.m. here and I'm not in physical pain as you are. For once, it's better to be later. So, that being said, we have a few beautiful cards to talk about today. I was going to say tonight as per usual. And I think people are going to love at least one of them. Like, you can't hate both of these cards.
Oh gosh, I hope you're right. I hope that's the case. So we're starting off with Hinata Dawncrowned. That's our new card for the week. And after we talk about some new concepts there, we'll also touch on our testing with Temeshi Reality Architect from last week.
That's perfect. Reality Architect is a beautiful title. Not as cool as Oberslime, because no one is ever going to crown the Oberslime, but it's cool enough.
So before we dive into all that, just want to give a quick shout out at the top to our Patreon, which is the best way to support the show. If you like what we do here at the Faithless Brewing Podcast and you want to throw us some support, you can find us at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. A pledge at any tier will get you access to our Discord channel. That's a place where we're always hanging out, throwing ideas around. We got a great community there.
Or you can just see us laugh with Dan about stuff he shouldn't and really doesn't want to talk about. Like the big titty. That's what we're here for, guys.
Half of these deep cuts more get cut out in the editing floor.
Oh, I know. I know. I just gotta give you the work to do so.
Emmy just like throws stuff out there just to see if any of it sticks.
I just try, you know, like
I was testing the waters, just saying stuff and seeing if any of it makes it into the final episode.
Something has to stick against the wall. Sometimes you will forget something. Something will just slowly go below. And the best part is if you cut down like the specific comment and then you leave these, it leaves people wondering, what did Borja say?
Exactly.
How did they go down this rabbit hole?
Many mysteries will be revealed in the Faithless Brewing Discord. Or just ping me if you're like, what the heck is he talking about?
What did Mord do now?
Yeah.
So, with that being said, why don't you tell us a bit about Hinata the Dawn Crowned, the beautiful Kirin? Maybe the first playable Kirin.
Oh, shots fired. So, this is a Kirin spirit, legendary creature. Jeskai colors, so one blue, red, white. 4/4 flying trample. Spells you cast cost one less to cast for each target. Spells your opponents cast cost one more to cast for each target. That's very interesting. We don't see cards like this very often. A little bit reminiscent of, what, like Thalia in terms of taxing opponent's stuff. Also reminiscent of cost reducers of your own, like, I don't know, Baral, Chief of Compliance or something.
I don't think we have ever seen something close to this sort of writing, to this specific effect.
Yeah, I guess it gives like a permanent ward to
everything, even spells on the stack. That's the weird part. Like, even countering costs one more, but like Arena 6 doesn't, so it's like in a really weird spot in the, what it taxes.
Right, right. So just to make sure we understand what's going on here, we're talking about a cost reduction for you on your generic mana costs. It will not affect color pips, so any card you cast that is going to target something on the stack will get reduced by one. So a negate, for example, because that targets a spell, will now cost a single blue pip. A counterspell, like actual counterspell, because that's just blue-blue, will not get any reduction. The second important thing is that reduction is only going to happen for spells with targets. Now, there are a lot of things that target things when they enter the battlefield or when they activate an ability or something like that. That does not work for Hinata. Hinata only cares about things that when you actually select all the modes, put it on the stack, you're selecting targets at that stage. That's where you get the benefit from.
Yeah, exactly. I have seen people ask, will this reduce a Solitude, tax a Fury or such? The answer is always no. EDV effects are just going to go afterwards.
So basically, we're talking about spells, instant sorceries, and technically auras. Auras will also target things when you put them on the stack. But that's about it in terms of what gets reduced by Hinata, which helps narrow down a little bit, but when you do go searching, you're basically searching for anything that targets that has some generic mana in it that can get reduced. So it's a pretty wide band of stuff to search for. And we've done a little bit of legwork here for you. We're not going to leave you out in the cold. We've got, you know, a list here. I've got about 40 speculative cards. And Emmy will help me choose the actual good ones.
As per usual, once you're looking at a new legendary card with a special effect, you just go to EDHREC. You just let the commander people do what they want, which is looking at the big flashy effects. And then you just pour it out. And then you have to do the filtering.
I've started doing that more since you've explained this trick, and it's pretty helpful. So yeah, the EDH rec page for Hinata as commander is pretty good. Now keep in mind, that's only going to show you stuff in Jeskai colors, and maybe we want to branch out beyond that. But it's a good starting place.
Exactly. So the first five cards that you showed here are close to the most important ones. March of the Swirling Mist, not as much, but it's a one mana. With Hinata on board, it's one blue mana, face everything your opponent has. Arisan Spear, Magma Opus, Dance of the Mans, and the Solemn Epiphany are likely the ones we have playtested the most in both Pioneer and Modern, and people will strive to make work because of how cheap they become. Magma Opus is 2 mana, Dance of the Mans is a master animation spell for 2 mana, and Solemn Epiphany costs between 3 and 2 depending on how many modes you can get, and can just flip a board on its own.
Yeah, and let's just walk through that more slowly because, you know, Magma Opus, that's an 8 mana spell, so you're saying you're going to get that for just 2 mana.
Exactly.
With Hinata in play.
So, as we read, Hinata says, has a really specific line of text, which is spells you cast cost 1 less to cast for each target. Which means with the Magma Opus, if I go like tap 2 of my opponent's lands, deal 1 damage spread around 1 to my opponent, 1 to 3 creatures, or 1 to 2 creatures, and 1 to myself. That's already 6 targets. And as we said, my Opus is an 8 mana spell. So we reduce by 6, 1 for each target at cost. We reduce it by 1 for each for targeting the 4 creatures or both players and 2 creatures. And for tapping both lands, you immediately get your 6 targets. So its spells cost go down to only 2. Dance of the Mans has a similar effect. You target X amount of stuff, so the cost of X always becomes 0, because for each adding target, you're also reducing 1 cost. So it always stays at 2.
Right, and there are a number of spells that have that template. They'll say, you know, up to X targets, and then the casting cost will have that X in the top right corner. So March of Swirling Mist, as Emmy said. Also cards like Aurelia's Fury has X targets. Icy Blast has X targets.
Inevitable Creativity.
Indomitable creativity, yeah. So if you want to creativity a bunch of stuff for just 3 mana, you can do that.
Exactly.
By force, if you want to wreck someone's artifacts, that destroys X artifacts for X and a red. So basically, when you have Hanada in play, you just ignore the X.
Exactly.
Pick as many targets as you want, which is kind of cool.
It just becomes like a sort of overload. Just target everything you want.
Exactly. So that's an X spell. Now, Sublime Epiphany is one of those cards that's actually kind of hard to find in a Scryfall search because it just says target a bunch of different times on the text of the card. It's a choose one or more situation, and between the five options, there are five different ways to target. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think Sublime Epiphany is a card that in order to get the five modes, it's like almost an impossibility. Like, I have only done it once in my lifetime, and it was just like the perfect dream scenario, because you need to counter both a spell and an activated or triggered ability on the same stack.
Yeah. So Ulamog, basically.
Exactly. Luckily, you don't need to get all five modes for it. You only cost 2 mana. You need to have something you want to bounce, something you want to copy, a card you want to draw, which is always, I think. Not wanting to draw a card is at least insane. And something to counter, a spell or an ability. So with any spell or ability on the stack, a creature you want to bounce and a creature you control, this costs 2 mana.
Now, I haven't cast Sublime Epiphany that often, but my sense is that getting it for 2 or 3 mana is worth it, right? I mean, it's still like a pretty big effect. You get a counter spell, you get to draw a card, and if you have a creature in play, you get to get a free token of it.
Exactly.
If there's something to bounce, you can bounce something.
What happened during my stream with the deck with the Hinata was like a really crazy. I was playing like an Ursa Shell, like we're gonna see in a few minutes, and my boy was playing Hammer, and once they went like play a Hammer, and I was like counter your Hammer, bounce your Ornithopter with Hammer, make a token of Ursa to get another construct, draw a card, and it was like just stabilize the board at instant speed. It was just like the maximum 4/1.
But is that really worth 2 mana, Emmy? Are you sure?
I mean, they could have played counter spell. Just for redundancy.
So what we're describing here are some spectacular cost reduction plays, right?
Yeah.
With Magma Opus, with Sublime Epiphany, and maybe with Dance of the Mance. And these are maybe the big three, right?
Those are the big three. The other three I would like to mention, mostly because of how interesting they are. It's Paradoxical Outcome, which for some reason says target. Where does Paradoxical Outcome target? We will never know. But it does.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. You could just not have a target.
It will be completely irrelevant because you just target as many as you want and there's no downside targeting more. So if your opponent wants to remove something, they could just do it on risk. The targeting there makes no sense whatsoever from a gameplay status. But it does for some reason. So with Hinata down, this is 1 blue mana, which means with a Hinata board, you can really easily just combo. Practically. That just makes me want to make bad decisions. Just listen to me. We didn't play Paradoxical Outcome or Barrel's Expertise. But, also Barrel's Expertise is 5 mana, becomes 2 mana, bounce 3 things, see target artifacts or creatures, and play a 4-drop for free. So it's like a big ritual.
A 4-drop is enough to recast Hinata if you wanted to do that for some reason, but I can't think of any reason why you would.
But here comes the important part. What about, listen to me, this is going to be a really bad idea, Paradoxical Outcome Hinata and our favorite Ponder?
Oh no.
Oh yes. Get Chig in the line.
You want to do a Kinnan deck?
I want to do a
We already have one bad card in the deck. We already have the Celestial Kirin. We can't have 2 knuckleheads in the same deck. Everything else has to be a good card.
But now we can have the Ponder's Prodigy.
Yeah, so we'll talk about some pioneer concepts that David sketched up for us. He's got a Paradoxical Outcome brew, and I noticed there was another Paradoxical Outcome deck that 5-0'd not that long ago that was using some really, I won't say bad cards, but yeah, Inspiring Statuary is a bad card. So there's some room for like a bad mana source. Maybe Kinnan can be the thing.
When you said the word inspiring, I thought you were going to say some inspiring deck choices as a... as a soft hit towards what the player was doing, and if they was like, no, Inspired Sanctuary is a bad card, I was like, where there goes?
Yeah, sorry.
There goes Common Decency out the window. I thought the phrase inspiring deck choices was gonna be like the soft hit, like the soft knock in the head. No, that just went for it.
I like that phrase though. Maybe we should start using that more.
It sounds a lot better, and we all know what it means. It's never inspiring.
Yeah, it's better than what do I usually say? Fun and interesting, I think that's what I usually say. But inspiring sounds better.
Then, also last two cards I want to talk about are Apostle's Blessing in Modern and Ephemeral Shields in Pioneer as one white mana, protect your, and, or, I mean as a zero mana, protect your Hinata from removal. Apostle's Blessing just becomes one Phyrex and white, so it's two life, protect your Hinata. And Ephemeral Shields has Convoke, so if Hinata is untapped, you can play it for free, but it gives an indestructible instead of protection from a color, so it's not as over it all, at least in Modern, where Solitude and Ending exist, and I would like to have Apostle's Blessing. I prefer two life and protect from exile. With that being said, I think that's all the relevant cards.
I think you're right. Nevertheless, I want to ask you about some of the irrelevant cards.
How about the inspiring deck choices?
Yeah, these are some inspiring deck choices. So I have a list here of about 50 cards. I will not read all 50, but I'll ask just a couple three. So first of all, cards that people actually play that do get a nice reduction from Hinata. Force of Vigor, 2 green green. If you ever have to hard cast that, you can now do that for just 2.
In your Sheskai deck, you can play green green for your spell on curve. That's what Modern has become.
That's exactly. Shatterskull Smashing is one that, you know, I could see myself putting into some decks. It's not a great deal or anything. It's always been a little bit expensive, but that does have 2 targets and it has an X, so you'll get.
You get at least one.
An additional 2.
Yeah, you get like one more damage on each for free. And that's not bad.
Finale of Promise targets 2 things. Now, the value of X is set by the casting cost of the things you're recasting. But, you know, it's a little less clunky than before.
And it goes sort of kind of infinite with like a Morphos. Not infinite, but like mana neutral plus 3 spells plus card draw plus a free sorcery.
Speaking of cards like Apostle's Blessing and Ephemeral Shields, these can protect Nada for free. The card Ghostly Flicker kind of does the same thing. You'll have to pay a blue. You'll get to flicker 2 things, say Hinata and then a land, and you end up where you started in terms of mana. Ghostly Flicker sometimes factors into infinite loops. I don't know if we want to like build something for that. Probably not.
It's like the... Just realizing Hinata is like the ultimate familiar. I haven't realized that. Hinata is like every single familiar, but on like steroids.
Exactly, so they just have to downshift it to common for Pauper, and then we'll really have something.
And then we can play it in Pauper, and then we can break the format again and ban Hinata in like an hour.
Do you have any love for Jaya's Immolating Inferno? This is a legendary sorcery, X red red. It requires up to 3 targets and then deals X damage to each of them. As we know, Hinata will give you a 3 mana discount if you have 3 targets.
So this is 2 mana, deal 9 damage, distributed 32 X. That's sort of board wipe effect, and it can also go face really fast.
So you deal to the opponent, and if they had 2 targets, you could do that. It's probably too situational to actually build around.
I mean, not really. If you are, you can just vault yourself. Always, you can always vault yourself.
Well, I don't want to do that. I'm not looking to cast the Flame Rift here. Yeah, you can bolt yourself, them, and Hinata for as much damage as you want.
No, wait. If your opponent has 1 creature and it's like 2 mana, deal 3 to opponent, Hinata, and them. And creature, Hinata, and opponent. And it's like a really bad, extremely requiring Searing Blaze. But yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's my problem. But the other card, actually, we talked about, we kind of showed it last time, and I think I saw it again, I like his Collective Defiance. That becomes like a 3 mana, shoot a creature, shoot your opponent, will effect.
So Collective Defiance uses the escalate mechanic, but because that is locked in when you cast it, you can get the discount from Hinata when you're choosing all your modes. So you can choose all the modes and cast all 3 modes of Collective Defiance for just red-red.
Exactly. So it becomes a 4-2 creature, 3-2 face, or the other way around. Let me see that.
3 to a creature. No, 4 to a creature.
4 to a creature, 3 to face, and a player wheels.
Yeah. All right, what else? I mean, a lot of the modal spells, the command cycles.
Of course.
When you choose the modes, you can have two or sometimes three targets. I think Primal Command is interesting. Probably not going to work out. Lorehold Command is in the correct colors. Maybe not for Modern, but Lorehold Command is a card we see paired with Hinata in Standard sometimes.
Lorehold Command is a really interesting card. Like, see, we had a chat like this not so long ago about what... I think... Oh, it was in Pioneer. We were talking about Dulcimir, and everyone was like, this is, like, strictly better Dulcimir. Don't ever play a Dulcimir again.
I mean, it kind of is. Now, sadly, you can only do two targets with Lorehold. Despite having four modes, the maximum number of targets is two. But that's still, like, a pretty good deal.
You still get a three mana... You get a three mana... 3-2 plus a Helix at instant speed, which is a lot.
Any love for Command the Dreadhorde or Fight with Fire?
Fight with Fire, no, you cannot make me love that draft staple. However, I hadn't considered Command the Dreadhorde, which is black reanimate both graveyards and lose a million life.
You lose some life, but not too much.
Yeah. That's the biggest problem. Like, I will have to pay a lot of life.
I guess Agadeem's Awakening could also be reduced pretty low if you had enough different stuff in your graveyard.
So, Agadeem's Awakening is go as high as you can in a ladder. Like, it was exactly as Dance of the Mans.
Right.
So, but it's limited to one per cost. So, if I had a 1 and a 2 and a 3 and a 5, it would cost me... Let me see how it's templated. So if you have everything in a ladder, it's 3 mana reanimate all.
Agadeem's Awakening, X black black black, sorcery. Return from your graveyard to the battlefield any number of target creature cards that each have a different converted mana cost, X or less. So let's say you had a 1, what are you saying, a 1 drop, a 2 drop, a 3 drop.
And a 5 drop, it's 4 mana reanimate all 5 of them. Or four of them. If you have a 4 drop, it becomes 3 mana. As long as you have it all chain, it's 3 mana. The moment you lack a step of the chain, it adds 1 mana to the cost.
I mean, that's kind of attractive, although it's hard to imagine a Hinata deck having black, black, black.
I'm an insane person. My mana base, I will do crazy stuff. I would play a Sheskai triple black deck until I have an expert, 3 expert triumphs, at least.
I mean, you're going to get your wish. They revealed the triumphs, the allied triumphs, just the other day in the new Capenna previews.
They're beautiful. They're so beautiful. Van Triumph, baby. We got Van Triumph.
All right, so those are like some of the big...
Big effects.
Big draws, if you can get a huge reduction. We're not naming cards that just get reduced by one, but there you'll want to like make sure that your list includes some number of cards like...
Much as there are Worldly Lights or... Mystical Dispute or anything that's gonna cost less if you have a Hinata.
Yeah, Fire Ice, a Braid. Valorous Dance is popular in Standard to pair with Hinata. It protects Hinata or it can remove an opponent's creature. Yeah, the March of Otherworldly Lights, I think, is a perfect card to pair with that. We talked about how it's less efficient than Prismatic Ending, but that's not true anymore with Hinata in play.
Exactly. Also, I'm just gonna say... Strictly Better Spreading Seas is Strictly Better Spreading Seas, and it's replacing Spreading Seas in Azorius Control, and I said it.
Yeah, how much is March of Otherworldly Light going for right now on Magic Online?
I'm just gonna say I bought 20 once I made that prediction. And now...
Oh.
It's... 15 ticks. Yeah. 15 ticks.
15 ticks in a set with Boseiju. Okay. Cashing in.
Is it the most expensive card of the set?
No, the green land is the most expensive.
Wow. But yeah, it's going up. The Wandering Emperor is also worth a million, just in case anyone was wondering. It's worth 27 ticks. I don't know why it's worth as much, but it is.
You tried to warn us. You told us that these two cards were going to be... Well, these two and the Spirited Companion. That one has not gone
up. But that's a common. I wasn't expecting that to go up. But on these two, actually, I'm just going to say, I had faith in them. Mono white is mono white. People didn't trust them in the good white cards. Just because they are nerfed because of their color. Like being white, being a card being white is automatically considered worse just because you have to play it in a white deck. Which
that's true.
Before Prismatic Ending and Aether Sentinel was like 100% a mistake. Slowly, white is coming up in the world with Solitude and Ephemerate and Ending, getting back into a decent spot. Poor Mono White.
All right, so before we jump at the list, just a few other things to keep in mind, and we can think about these as we look at the deck lists. We've been focusing on Hinata reducing your own spells. It does more than that, right? It's also a 4-4 body.
We trample. I'm flying.
I guess we'll see if that's relevant. I don't know if Hinata actually needs to close the game out, or if it's just here to be like a glorified
familiar. It's better to have a 4-4 than an 0-2 when you hope it survives the turn.
True.
Like,
true.
That's becomes really relevant really fast when your opponent's like playing balls or such, and they need like a fatal push plus. They need a 2-mana fatal push plus 3 ball to kill it in some scenarios or stuff like that.
Yeah, when you're trying to figure out if Hinata will survive, keep in mind that your opponent is being taxed, and sometimes it's hard to like see that unless you can see their side of the board. But we have a lovely screenshot here from Bomat Courier in our Discord where he's on the opposing side, his opponent has Hinata in play. And all of his stuff in his Auras deck just costs double, and he's very land late. So it's possible that just getting Hinata down...
It's relevant mostly against Ending. 5 mana is a lot more than 4 in the mid game.
Yeah, exactly. The last question is going to be, you know, to what extent can we really build around Hinata? It's a very, very unique effect, as we've been saying. We're not going to have redundancy. We're definitely not going to have a rule of 8, per se.
Sort of.
How are we going to account for that when we choose the cards in the deck? Are we going to choose cards that swing for the fences, that are like really, really fantastic with Hinata, but don't work with anything else? Or are we going to go for more of like a smaller approach, you know, little cards that get a nice boost from Hinata, but are also fine cards on their own?
Well, so I took to that exact concept of Modern. The first deck I was drafting with, of course, everything, whenever I say build a deck, unless I specifically say so, assume it has 80 cards, like, as a constant variable. If I don't say it's 60 cards, it's 80 cards. If I brew a deck, if I build a deck list, it's 80. Like, I have to say I build a 60 in order for it to not be so, because I just start with the Yorion and decide. I start with between 27 and 32 lands and then a Yorion before I do anything else. So, with that in mind, I built a deck and I was like, okay, if you sort of need the rule of 8 in 60, you really, really need a rule of 8 in 80. So the first idea was, what about like a big Sheskai? And eventually I came to the problem that the only way to have more Hinatas in a Yorion deck was play Eladambra's Call, because it's the only decent tutor for it.
Mm-hmm.
Or scrap the idea and play a sort of false rule of 8 with Ursa, which doesn't cheapen spells, but gives you a lot of mana.
So you're saying that Hinata is just a mana engine. Let me find a second mana engine to pair with it.
Exactly. That was exactly the line of reasoning. Sort of like the old Ursa plus Wilderness Reclamation lists. Just trying to find 4-drops that make mana. I just want a lot of mana because I'm playing big spells.
Ursa plus Wilderness Reclamation? Was that actually a deck?
Not a good one.
I don't remember that at all. Okay.
But it was. It was the Oko era. You could do whatever you want, just cast turn 2 Oko and then play random nonsense and still win because Oko.
What a time to be alive.
What a time to be alive. I miss you, baby. My sweet prince.
Alright, so your initial Hinata build in Modern
was a big Sheskai, yeah.
You shared with us an early version a few weeks back, but what did you learn from... You actually tried a couple iterations on this. So which cards you end up finding to be like the important cards in the deck, and which ones were the filler?
So I went 3-2 and 3-2. The first league was a lot of luck. The second league was a bit of unluckiness, so I think the deck leagues got a bit better. I didn't draw Hinata that much. Like, I think I casted Hinata every single game I drew it, and I drew it like 5-6 times. So a lot of the time I was just playing like a big Sheskai. The big payoff was Dance of the Mans, because you had Ursa Saga, Chromatic Stars, Esper Sentinels, a lot of cards that just go to the graveyard naturally, because Esper Sentinel has to die, Mox Amber, you just get your Legendary sometime, Chromatic Star, Ursa Saga, a lot of stuff that just Emery for milling, etc., etc., and explosives. So we just played a long, grindy game. We had Portable Holsters removal that opponent removes as well. And with that, we just get to a scenario where we get like 5 or 6 mana, or we play a turn for Hinata into next turn. White and play a blue and a white, and X equals 6 or 7, reanimate 7 artifacts, and get 7 4/4s on the board to just take a hold of the game. Fun part is also the... what's the cycle with the bounce and the spell bomb cycle doesn't need to tap to activate. So even if a creature, you can sacrifice them to bounce or bolt stuff. You're sacrificing a 4/4 for a bounce, but it was necessary more than once.
So you're saying even after you reanimate everything with Dance of the Mints and get this giant army, you still need to sacrifice your spell bomb to stay alive?
I'm just blaming. No, not just stay alive, but they had a construct with I think it was 2 hammers and a shadow spear. So a 23/23 is worth almost as much as 8 4/4s.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, that construct was not going to see the light of day. Also, I trimmed down on the Magma Opus. I had like 8 payoffs at first, which was like double Sublime Epiphany. Epiphany felt amazing, especially as it did double blue and as the cost, which allows me to just cast it with Ursa and forget about it. Like, it works a lot better with Ursa. And I had to cut down on the 2 Magma Opus I was testing, as it didn't feel good enough at all. And it's also bugged on MTGO, so it's really annoying.
So in terms of your big payoffs for getting Hinata in play, you're starting with 4 Dance of the Mants. That's your primary 4 of, and that's why you built this artifact-based deck that will eventually fill up the graveyard just from playing naturally. But you're playing a total of, it looks like, 7 or 8 big spells between, you know, the extra copies of Sublime Epiphany, Magma Opus.
And a one of Paradoxical Outcome in the new list.
Right, so the good cards, basically.
Yeah.
We're hoping that Dance is the best one, but we also have some additional payoffs.
We're just hoping to play, if we don't draw the Hinata, we can play a reasonable base of a deck. Ursa is going to give us a lot of mana. We can assume we're going to draw at least one of our 4-offs in any grindy game, having 8. Odds are you will find at least 1. So you can afford to just play a slow grindy game. However, I think the biggest take was, sadly, Hinata might have been a bit too slow, and it was like a power display of Moonsnare Prototype being an amazing magic card. It was insane how good Prototype was in this sort of shell, and it really explains why the 8-cast deck that got popular a few weeks ago and lasted a few days did so. Card is just insanely good. Gives you so many turn 1, Mithras Bubble, and Prototype, type 4 colorless, drum, go with 4 artifacts on board turn 1 consistently.
So is it fair to say at this point, now that we're a few weeks in, that the most important card for Modern outside of the lands has been Moonstar Prototype?
You're putting me in a pickle. Is it?
I mean, I know you like the white cards. I know you like Wandering Emperor and March of Otherworldly Light.
No. Actually, I'm not fighting against those. Like, those are not the ones in my mind. I'm actually thinking about Hidetsu Consumes All.
Interesting. I mean, we're maybe at the beginning of a Hidetsugu revolution, but I don't think that's like a widely adopted piece of tech yet. This is the Mythic Rare Saga.
I just want to say Hidetsugu is 23 ticks. Hidetsugu is the 3rd most expensive card in the set. Boseshu, Wandering Emperor, Hidetsugu, March of Otherworldly Lights.
So what you'll find for Hidetsugu is some people are just putting 3 or 4 copies into their deck.
Yeah.
And some are doing the same thing, but in the sideboard. Because I think people have not decided yet whether this is actually a useful general tool or if it's just meant to crush hammer decks.
I think the problem with Hidetsugu is it's one of those amazing cards that are really far away from a shell. Because if you're playing Rixis, you're playing Rakdos, you're playing Mardu, you're playing Lurus. It's really hard for Hidetsugu to outclass that. Fran Efpolus had a really fun Grixis Yorion decklist with 4 Hidetsugu in the main deck.
Grixis Yorion?
Yeah, that's how he got me into the stream, exactly. Okay. He said the magic word. I like your funny words, magic man. And I was like, okay, I mean. And Hidetsugu, like, Even against non-Hammer, he got like a 4-1, didn't play against a single Hammer or Grixis deck, and sometimes the card just destroyed two Amulets and all the constructs against Amulet Titan, destroyed a Ragavan and a Darcy against Izzet. Like, how many games of Valorant have been won by Engineered Explosives on 1, and this is like Engineered Explosives on 1 plus 0?
So for people who are not familiar with the card, it's 1 Black Red Saga, Chapter 1, destroy each non-land permanent with mana value 1 or less. So that's that effect more just talking about Engineered Explosives for 1. Chapter 2, exiles all graveyards. That actually is sometimes a downside, depending on how you built your deck.
That's the biggest problem. If you're playing a Grixis shell in Modern, it's pretty likely you're playing Crocs or such, and that's going to hit you. So the problem with Gigate 2 is not its raw power, it's how you make it fit.
Yeah, although when it goes to Chapter 3, you do get to transform it, and it comes back as a 3-3 trample. And that 3-3 trample sometimes gets additional counters, it depends.
Also, I realize it doesn't get the counters when it deals damage to player, which is what I thought it did. It's when it deals any damage.
Interesting. So if I block this, if I block the backside of Hitetsugu with a 3-3...
No.
It still kills it.
It still kills it, but if you block it with a 2, if you chop it with a 2-2 or it blocks, like if you attack it against it, it's gonna grow.
Okay.
So that was a bit more relevant. That was a bit relevant in some games. But yeah, so you get a small Wrath effect, and someone in the Faithless Brewing, I don't know if you saw this deck list, because it was like, it went really, it was sent by Logan, it just went like really low. It was a Mardu Oboz shell with Ephemerate and Hitetsugu, because once it becomes a creature, you can Ephemerate to make a more wipe again.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah, I know the deck you're talking about. I saw it in our Discord the other day.
And had Season Pyromancer, Fury, Solitude, Ephemerate, the whole removal package, Forest Burst Sentinel, and it was like, you can Ephemerate Hitetsugu.
I mean, that's pretty slick. It's not just like a bonus creature, it's potentially a surprise Wrath.
That was also Frank's argument with Yorion. You can Yorion it again on any of the, in any of the steps to get another Wrath.
Oh.
So, it's an interesting card. I don't think Hitetsugu... I think people... Eventually, they're going to find a shell. And if that happens, the card is going to see a lot of play. Because its biggest problem right now is not power. It's finding the correct shell for a Rakdos card that hits on your own graveyard and it's more than Lurus cost.
Yeah.
But the fact it was amazing against Amulet Titan, just clearing the whole constructs, plus the Grazers, plus the Amulets.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It just starts to find random uses in a lot of matches. And if you have Blood Moons, you kill Lavundan Growths and Utopia Sprawls.
So that's Hitetsugu consumes all. Let's wind our way back. So we were talking about Hinata Dawnground, exactly. Wondering whether Moonstare Prototype is the real star of this Jeskai deck.
No, oh, and it is the star in this Jeskai deck. Like, going back to that, damn, my ramblings go off sometimes. Sorry about that, everybody.
Well, I tricked you into that line of conversation.
You gave me the slightest nudge in the general direction, and you just...
I mean, just name cards you like from Neon Dynasty. Go.
Why would you do that, Dan? You know me. You're like, we're going straight to the right side, and Nasha says, I mean, look at the left, and I just start walking towards the left. You just have to make me look at sort of the correct road and I'm going to fumble my way out of it. And you just lure me into the trap. So with that being said, yeah, Prototype was an amazing card in this sort of deck. And also we channeled it a lot in the mid game.
Oh, you did?
Like at least 4 times I channeled Prototype as a removal spell that was essential to win.
So 4 and a blue, you can channel the Prototype to kind of like Aether Gust something, but it can target anything.
That's, yeah, it's non-land permanent. You just Aether Gust a non-land.
Now, that's not considered casting a spell, so you will not get a cost reduction from Hinata for that.
No, you're 100% correct. But still, the effect is just so powerful. Like, when I first read it, I thought it was too hand, and it felt interesting. And when I realized it was anywhere, I was like, wait, what? Like, the top of board is like, this is actual card advantage, I mean, equal card parity on my mana rock. Like, mana rock in the early game, removal on the late game, and controllable removal at that, it's just Wow. That's really, really interesting. And it happens more than you expect when you're playing it, especially when you have Ursa and you have a lot of mana and you just never play it again.
So in terms of the future of this deck, do you feel like Hinata was pulling its weight?
I think it was barely. Like, the amount of setup you have to do, like, I don't know if it's better than the Yorion decklist from someone like Da Vinci, which is, like, extremely similar in concept. Also, the mana base at Sheskai with Forza Saga sometimes felt pushing.
Mm.
That extra color from Hinata can actually hurt you slightly a few times too many. Even if you're playing, like, Zero Mountains.
If you were not playing Hinata, you would basically not want to play Dance of the Mans.
Yeah, exactly. That's the biggest... Dance of the Mans wasn't that bad. I actually casted it a lot of the times with Ursa. Like, I can see myself playing two in a regular, just a solid shell, but not the whole playset. But yeah, the deck was fun, the deck was interesting, but I think Hinata might have to stay, at least for now, in Pioneer as its shell, which leads us to our biggest discoveries.
Yeah, so let's jump over to Pioneer. David, our resident brewmaster, has been cooking up a few different Pioneer lists, and he actually tested one already, and he just fired off a 5-0. So he's already got a 5-0 in the bag with a four-color Hinata deck. A super sweet list. We can talk about that one first, I guess. Four Hinata Dawncrowned, and we're in four color, so we need to actually accelerate Hinata out. So we're looking at the Sylvan Caryatid Triome package, which is one of the core pillars, if you subscribe to David's theories of the pillars of Pioneer. So four Caryatid will help us cast four Hinata Dawncrowned. We're also in Omnath colors, so we have four Omnath Locus of Creation.
Because why not?
Four Growth Spiral, four Expressive Iteration. So that's kind of the core of the deck. You have probably a tap land on turn one, Caryatid or Growth Spiral on turn 2 to help you catch up, powerful engine on turn 3 in the form of Hinata or Omnath. And then the rest of that is finding the right support spells. We're going to choose spells that keep us alive while also providing that big payoff when Hinata is in play. And our biggest one is going to be Magma Opus. Exactly as Morg was saying, we can get the maximum cost reduction here, cast it for just 2 mana, which is insane. But we're also playing March of Otherworldly Light, another card that Hinata reduces, 4 copies of that, 2 copies of Settle the Wreckage. If you read Settle very closely, it does target your opponent. So that means you'll get it for just 3 mana. And David has some exquisite screenshots here.
Settle doing
his aura players sending their entire army into the void.
You just remind me of the old times when I started playing Modern and Settle targeted so Vogel players cyborg in Leyland of Sanctity against Azorius control.
Oh, gosh.
It was an unholy place.
I mean, you might not realize that. If you see your opponent has, like, Hinata on the board and 3 mana open, you might think you're safe.
You would never. No. There's a lot of things I wouldn't play around, and I think the top of that list is I never play around Settle. Why would you play around Settle in 2022?
Even if your opponent keeps on spamming good game at you.
You just go in with everything.
They're giving you all the information they can that they're going to settle you.
You just go in with everything and pray it doesn't happen.
So we've got 2 settles, 4 March of Otherworldly Light, 1 Ephemeral Shield, 1 Sublime Epiphany. 26 lands.
And just to let everyone know, this is a relevant thing. Magma Opus is slightly bugged on MTGO.
Yes.
The second tap, like the second thing you select to tap, takes like a billion damage, like 12,000 damage for some reason. So, first, try not to scam everyone away, just try to, for your second tap to be a land, because also, and if not, expect everyone to be annoyed it's a bug, and it's just something you will have to have in the back of your mind. We have a lot of screenshots from David here just going like, deal once your creature, tap your land, deal 12,000 damage to your other land. Which is just...
Take that, Hallowed Fountain. You know what you did.
You know what you did. You take 64 damage to the face. But yeah, besides that, that's the only like TSA from the PSA from the deck. Just know that before getting it. And once you see it, no, it's an usual bug, but you can just play around it by making sure the second tap is on a land or something that's going to die regardless. It shouldn't be too big of a problem.
So I like the looks of this deck. You can find it already in the deck dump from this past week. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, of course. I've seen some people trying it already with mixed results, but I mean, it's pretty exciting. It's very different looking from what we're used to seeing in the Pioneer meta.
It's like a four-color shell.
If you step back, it's just like four-color Omnath, but that's not a very popular archetype in Pioneer right now. And you need something besides Omnath to like really have that broken angle, and Hinata plus Opus can be that thing. Oh, there's two Torrential Gearhooks. I should mention that too. You do want you do want Magma Opus to not be completely terrible, and Gearhooks gives you another route to cast it.
If you want to turn to discard turn five Haragast, it's 100% available. And also, someone told us about the living the dream of Magma Opus your opponent into Torrential Gearhulk, Sublime Epiphany, copy Gearhulk, cast Magma Opus.
Oh yeah. That's like the actual dream. Like, how many Torrential Gearhulks do you end up with after this sequence?
You just discard a Magma Opus, you just get a Sublime Epiphany in your graveyard and just go, okay, I'm casting Sublime. In response to your spell, cast Gearhulk, bounce your creature, counter your spell, draw a card, copy my Gearhulk, put out a second Gearhulk, cast a Magma Opus, destroy your two creatures, tap your land, draw a card, draw two cards, get a 4/4. And that's like just the perfect 6-mana play in the history of Magic.
Yeah. So that's the dream.
That's a dream. With that being said, I love how much March of Arbor Lights has become a staple removal in Pioneer. With the lack of Prismatic Ending, it just becomes like so much better in comparison to the rest.
Oh yeah. Yeah, this has become like the go-to removal in Pioneer. I mean, it hits all the problem stuff. So you might be facing someone with like a Light Pause with 6 auras on it. Or you might be facing a Darksteel Citadel with an Ensoul Artifact on it. You just don't know what's going to come at you. You might have an Oni Cult Anvil on the other side of the board. March of Otherworldly Light just becomes super important.
It's just so versatile in its effect. And the fact you can just get rid of like the Darksteel Citadel for 1 white mana is at least devastating.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a 4-color build that has already proven successful. We have 2 more to consider here. Drawing on some of the lessons from the 4-color build, David is asking, well, what if we just want to simplify things? Maybe cut out the green.
Why don't you say Sky?
So we have more room for inspiring cards, as we might say.
So what if we take out a color, take out good cards with that color, and just make inspiring deck choices that we hope work?
Yes. Right, so we've cut Sylvan Caryatids, we've cut the Omnas and the Growth Spirals, and that gives us just about enough room to fit in Mindlink Mech and Efreet Flame Painter.
This is not a good idea.
This I love this. This is amazing. Okay, so Efreet Flame Painter, 1/4 for 3 and a red with double strike. Whenever Efreet Flame Painter deals combat damage to a player, you get to cast target instant or sorcery card from your graveyard for free. Super powerful effect, but it's a 1/4 with no evasion. You just like can't realistically do this. However.
But.
However. Yes. Mindlink Mech, which is actually extremely good. I've played a Mindlink Mech deck, and the rest of the deck was not good, but Mindlink Mech was amazing. So this is the new vehicle. 2 and a blue for a 4/3 flying vehicle, crew 1, and when you crew it with a non-legendary creature, you get to have the Mindlink Mech become a copy of that creature. So the dream is play your Mindlink Mech, turn 3, turn 4, slam the Efreet Flame Painter, crew up the mech becomes a 4/3 flying double strike that when it connects for 8 damage, also casts 2 spells from your graveyard for free. So you got your spells here, you got Consider, you have a Braid, Expressive Iteration, Magma Opus. You've got 2 Lore Hole Command, 2 Prismari Command. These are all more or less reasonable spells. Some of them really only function with this Hinata / Mindlink Efreet combo going. But some are just like good spells.
I think that the amazing part is that the Mindlink Mech not only gives it flying, gives it a bigger body, it gives it like also haste, because you just play it on curb and you just attack on turn 4.
Yeah.
Like, you cast it on 4 and just go in.
I mean, it sounds silly, but I think it's like not that ridiculous. I think the hardest part will actually be having 2 spells in your graveyard for maximum benefit, but even just casting Magma Opus once is probably good enough.
Yeah. Yeah, just getting 1 spell should be enough, especially if it's Opus, or like double iteration, dig like 6 cards, see what happens.
Yeah, you also dealt 8 damage to them because you had a 4-3 flying double strike. It's actually not crazy. I do think it's a little slow, so I think this build will play out a little bit more of it as a controlling deck without any kind of mana acceleration at all.
Also, you have no way of putting Lorehold Command or Epiphany into your graveyard besides like random milling it out with Consider.
About 2 Prismari Commands.
Oh, you have, yeah, or let's you bring Prismari Commands, yeah. But then you can do it before turn 4. So we just go into Azorius and we play Faithful Mending. And we just make bad deck choices. Inspiring deck choices.
Inspiring deck choices, thank you. Alright, one last Hinata sketch here. This one using Paradoxical Outcome. A card that we are saying is a good card. We don't have a lot of evidence to back that up. Paradoxical Outcome has not been super successful outside of Vintage.
And even there, it has been slowly being pushed back by the new cards in Magic.
But it's so tantalizing. Like, I just want this card to be amazing.
You just look at it and it's tempting.
So if you want to build a Paradoxical Outcome deck in Pioneer, we actually have an example from Tiamu. They 5-0'd with a mono-blue Paradoxical Outcome deck a few weeks back. It had Inspiring Statuary, 4 copies of that. It had Hullbreaker Horror, 2 copies of that. A thing that, you know, I was hoping we could achieve during Hullbreaker Horror Week. You know, just get it down and then you can start looping 0 drops.
You just go infinite.
You have Tormod's Crypt, you have Mox Amber, you even have Briber's Purse, which is do nothing, 0 cast artifact that just sits there on the battlefield. Moonstare Prototype is probably the most important pickup for this archetype. 4 of that, 4 Renegade Maps.
Exactly.
There's even 1 copy of Burrell's Expertise. So there's a lot of stuff in Tiamu's shell that might have you thinking Hinata. So with that inspiration, maybe we can see how David put his list together.
You got inspired by the statuary?
Inspired by the statuary to cut the statuary from the list and replace it with Hinata.
With Hinata.
We've cut Inspiring Statuaries because that card is actually quite bad, to be honest.
Yeah.
Now we get a 4-4 Flample instead. We still have to play the usual number of cheap stuff. So we got Moonsnare Prototypes, Mox Ambers, Springleaf Drums, Ornithopters. That's a 16 card package that is kind of the best you can do in Pioneer for cheap stuff. David, I think, couldn't bring himself to play Briber's Purse, so he's playing Mox Ambers instead.
Briber's Purse is... that's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's... that's just quality bad cards. Just play the whole playset of Fumbers, just don't make me look at that card in the face. Don't make me read that.
No, you don't have to read it. But yeah, so if you want to play the 8 drum core in Pioneer, you don't have Memnite, so you have to play Mox Amber instead.
Yeah.
And your 4 Ornithopters. For Legends, 4 Emery, 4 Psy, 4 Hinata. These are the best artifact adjacent Legends, I think. Emery and Psy. 3 Metallic Rebukes, 4 Golden Egg. A card that I would love to cut. Maybe it's a necessary evil, you just need to have something that cantrips. I would probably play Prophetic Prism first, just because we are trying to splash Hinata into basically a mono blue deck.
Yeah, that's exactly what was said. But maybe just play the experiment, since the experimental synthesizer is also a dream synthesizer.
Yeah, I mean that does draw a card on leaving the battlefield. So if you Paradoxical Outcome it,
it feels extremely greedy with the mana base, and I'm not a good mana base expert in Pioneer, so I don't know how much you can push it. But it seems so tempting.
Yeah, the mana is going to be tight. I mean, we've already only got room for 19 lands.
Exactly. Also, I can't believe Mystic Sanctuary is Pioneer legal still. It's quite shocking to see.
It is. So Tiamu, because he was playing mono blue, was able to play 3 Mystic Sanctuaries alongside 17 islands. We're going to have to give that up. If we want to splash Hinata, we've got to play Spire of Industry, Shocklands.
Yeah, we need a good mana base.
Pathways and stuff. But that should be more or less doable. We don't need to cast Hinata right away, and we have Springleaf Drum to help with that. To finish out the deck, 1 Burrell's Expertise and 1 Aetherflux Reservoir.
The Reservoir as the one true win con.
That's all you need.
You only need a Reservoir. What a weird word. Like, it sounds so French. It's so French, but in English.
Yeah, it's got all these extra R's and V's in there that we're not using.
So. And the OI that's like unexisting in English. as a war.
True.
But yeah, going down that, out of that spiral before I go down, I think with a few changes, I really like the Hinata Outcome one, but I think it's like too combo-centric. Mm. I really prefer the 4-color version because it's something I can see myself playing, like eight ramp spells in the form of Sylvan Calradian and Growth Spiral, 8 value spells in the form of Expressive Iteration and Omnath, and the Hinata Magma Opus combo as a way to go over other mid-range decks. Just having like that big setup. Also, David was also talking about here, specifically about the interaction we talked a few minutes ago, like March is insane in this deck, and making your opponent pay 6 mana to kill a Hinata is like extremely expensive.
Yeah, not a lot of things in Pioneer can kill Hinata. People rely on March of Otherworldly Light, Fatal Push without Revolt. I mean, these are the cards that you'll be up against.
Exactly.
Fatal Push has Revolt more often now than it used to. That's a little bit of a shame.
Hmm.
But beyond that, I mean, yeah, I think it's a reasonable expectation that if you cast Hinata, you can maybe pass the turn and have a decent chance of untapping with it.
Yeah, and that's like what you're aiming for with this deck.
So, those are 3 Pioneer concepts with Hinata. We're going to be testing them some more, and we'll report back next week on what we've learned.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think that's all. Yeah, all the deck list, all the archetypes. Don't try it in Modern unless you have some amazing idea I would love to hear before that. And if you're playing a Pioneer, please try the 4-color deck first. It just looks amazing.
Speaking of decks not to try in Modern, we do have to follow up on our Temeshi testing, and we have some wild lists. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will have our flashback segment and tell you all about how that went. Stick around. Welcome back. Last week we talked about Temeshi Reality Architect. Or I talked about it. I kind of went way off the deep end. I was like far down the rabbit holes, and it turns out when you go down there, there's even more deep tunnels and dark caverns. And I've only now, just now, reemerged. I've spent a week plus in the brand new Temeshi Discord where it's wild in there. It's a wild place.
New Discords without 5-0s are just the wild wasteland. You're just gonna head first into the mayhem.
There's more than 100 people in it now. Davius Minimus has been leading the charge on Temeshi, and he's done a great job promoting it, getting people excited. That being said, no one has 5-0'd. There's been a fair number of 4-1s, but a lot of just speculation, inspiring deck building, we can say. And it's a very confusing place.
You don't have someone you really want to hear, just a lot of people saying, do this. And I'm like, should I? Is this the way? Are you as inspired as I think you are?
That being said, Davius has tested Temeshi. He's tested the heck out of it. He's got to be like 100 plus matches in at this point.
Pretty likely.
And most of them are up on his YouTube channel. So we'll talk first about sort of what he's been trying. I've seen a few people pick it up. I know a couple streamers. I think Freaky Nasty was streaming a similar version.
Extremely close.
Mord, you picked it up yourself. And I tested his list too, so we can sort of give our assessments.
So before we talk about results and such, I want to explain a bit about what are these 2 deck lists doing? Like, what is the main plan of Temeshi in Modern?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what you're trying to achieve mostly, if you look at the deck list, it looks like one of the weirdest pile of cards I have ever seen. You are going to see Esper Sentinel, Goblin Engineer, which makes sense. Then you see Temeshi and you're like, okay. And then you see Cultivator Colossus, which makes it really fun because your mana costs are white, red, blue, triple green, into 15 mana Emrakul. Below that, you have 2018's Magic Staple Wargate, followed by Modern Horizons 1 Staple Eladam Race Call, followed by Ex Ad Nauseam Staple Lotus Bloom, and for some reason, a Burrowing Hole. So, what does every card in this beautiful pile amount to? Like, why are we doing this? Why does the Freaky Nasty play Teferi, and why does Davius does not? The reason is, this whole pile of cards is just trying to turn again and turn again, slam a combo at your opponent's face and hope it resolves. That's the plan. You just slam that, try to combo, you fail, try to combo, you fail, try to combo, they stop it, try to combo, they are out of answers. And how do we accomplish this? The combo here is the interaction between Tameshi and Lotus Bloom alongside Cultivator Colossus. When you activate Tameshi, you pay a white, you bounce any land, and you put in a Lotus Bloom. You sacrifice a Lotus Bloom, you get 2 mana, you get 3 mana, and you go up 2 mana with every single iteration of that. You go 2 mana of any color. So you start with 5 lands, let's say you make 10 mana. What do you do with that 10 mana? Well, we can play Cultivator Colossus now, and we have at least 5 lands in hand because we just bounced them. So we are going to at least put those 5, draw at least, this is a mathematical, at least 5 new cards, which are likely going to be closer to 8 or 9. Put those 8 or 9 new lands into play, bounce them all back, get 16, 18 mana, play another Colossus, go again, go up to 26 mana or like 13, 14 lands, until we just have found most of our deck. We can play an Emrakul and have like a 20, 20 Colossus, an Emrakul in play, an extra turn, and anything else we can do with like a 40 mana and win the game on that exact turn. Esper Sentinel is an amazing way to force your opponent to interact with you, or if they don't kill it because they want to hold up a removal, give you cards as they try to outgrind your combo pieces. Goblin Engineer has a value with Portable Hole and is a way to instantly, and is a way to draw Lotus Bloom. Tameshi is just your combo engine. You can get it with Wargate, you can get it with Eladan Risk also. It's like playing 12 Tameshis. And Cultivator Colossus, you can actually get with the same way. You have 12 of them. Getting it with Wargate, it's a bit expensive. 10 mana Cultivator Colossus, it's tough to combo. You will need like a good setup for that. And finally, you just have Wargate as a tutor specifically because of how easy it gets Lotus Bloom. 3 mana get Lotus Bloom into play. It's just a really good setup for a turn 4 kill. Like turn 3 Dura, turn 4 Tameshi, sacrifice Lotus, get 3 white, start going off, will happen with a certain degree of consistency.
So if you listened carefully to Emmy's explanation of the combo, your first Cultivator Colossus needs to find you a second Cultivator Colossus, and then you can just keep going. When I initially like looked at how Davias had put the deck together, I was worried that maybe what happens if you don't draw a second Cultivator Colossus? In practice, I've seen that happen 0 times. Every time you find a second one, because there's so many tutors in here. There's just so many tutors. And because the first Cultivator Colossus puts your land back, you still have the Tameshi Lotus Bloom loop, so you just have unlimited mana at this point.
After the first Colossus, even Wargate becomes Colossus.
Right.
So you will have literally 11 extra copies of Colossus in your deck. 7 mana, 9 mana, and 10 mana respectively. And you're just gonna go ahead and do so spectacularly. Dan, is this a Broadback deck? Dan, can we play Broadback? Dan, I want you to Broadback Lotus Bloom.
Emmy, I invite you to come to the Tameshi Discord and make your case. You have to win over the crowd, convince them.
I'm going to enter the Discord, send a picture of Broadback, and go away. And just leave the Discord. And just hope someone takes the bait and sends it down the slippery hole and just ruins his day. Trying to brew. Oh, that's all. I'm only saying that because for some reason he's playing 4 seals in the sideboard in every single deck list.
Well, it's because Tameshi is really good with permanents that can put themselves back in the graveyard, so it does become an effective tool, like drawing one Seal of Cleansing in the sideboard.
Value tool.
Gives you access to that every turn, potentially, if Tameshi's in play. Now, is the game actually going to play out that way? That's a little bit less clear. I think the way that Emmy described it, as you try to combo, you fail, you try again, they stop you, you try again. This is how this deck plays out. And we said this last week. This combo uses every zone, it uses the stack, it uses every type of permanent. They're going to have at least 6 or 7 things in their deck without even trying that completely interrupt the combo. There's no way around that. The only way around that is either to get Teferi in play, or, as Davias does, just plow through. And it's surprisingly good at plowing through.
I agree. That's why I don't like the seals. Like I have seen a lot of Davias replay. I have seen Freakon stream. I have seen your comments, I have played it, and I have never gotten back a seal with Tameshi. And the one time I did, it wasn't like game winning, and like having something more powerful, like a Force of Vigor or a Nature's Claim for tempo efficiency would have been better in every single other scenario. Even if it doesn't have a specific synergy, once I have a Tameshi, I'm trying to win, I'm trying to make value. in like 99% of the spots.
So you played this list, Emi. What were your impressions and how did it go for you?
So first of all, I didn't play exactly Sassiuri. I didn't play Thrive Inspector, which you hated. I played Forteferi, which I didn't hate. So I can agree, if you are going to fire this again, take out the Thrive Inspectors at Forteferi or for proactive plays.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm really close to just also saying, screw the Teferi, just play four Brennan sixes because I miss a lot of land drops and I want to go like to mm-hmm. like down to like 23 lands and play four Brennan six and maybe two Teferi's main deck. Because I really struggle to play four color piles and not play a Brennan six. It's just so free. The card is just so stupidly good as a win the game on its own plan.
Yeah, I also added Brennan sixes. I don't have it in my screenshot here, but my second league, I played two leagues with the shell and
yeah.
I had the same experience of like, man, like, why am I missing land drops in a deck that you can't combo without four lands?
I need like four or five lands.
Five would be even better. So every extra land you have between your hand and graveyard and in play makes your cultivator that much more powerful. It's just so good. So
exactly.
Squeezing in more Renin 6 makes total sense to me.
Besides that, yeah, I like the concept. It's not my style of deck, as you know. For me to play a combo, it has to be an actual mid-range deck with a combo and not a combo deck that sometimes mid-ranges.
Mm.
It's a huge difference, everybody. I know it sounds like I'm just being obnoxious, but there's a huge difference in how you sit up, look at your seven and go, okay, I like this. You just really, you don't like the hands that go turn 2, Brennan 6, turn 3, Teferi. You're looking at the hands that go turn 1, Esper Sentinel, turn 2, get a Dameshi, turn 3, get a Lotus Loom, turn 4, try to win. It's like a whole different setup.
Right, like your opening hand will be four lands, Lotus Bloom, Wargate, and Cultivator Colossus. Is that a keep? Like that is the whole combo right there.
If you're comboing, it is.
You just need the Lotus Bloom in the graveyard. Come off, suspend on turn four, use the Lotus Bloom to cast Wargate for Temeshi. That is the combo.
Yeah.
Is that a good hand? I mean, that is all the deck is built to do. And this is the kind of question you're just going to be confronted with this game after game.
I mean, then. Am I willing to just lose the game to a Lightning Bolt? And you're just going to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you lose to a Lightning Bolt. It really depends. So most people will kill the Temeshi right away, and then you'll just know whether the coast is clear. I've seen one or two opponents get really clever. They'll let Davius bounce all his lands, and then they'll kill the Temeshi.
And he will be...
Which is hilarious when that happens.
Just in like the worst possible spot.
Yeah. So I should say that after about 100 matches, Davius feels like he's hit a bit of a wall. Like he started off at a 60% win rate, which is really, really promising. You know, a lot of 3-2s, some 4-1s, but almost always a 3-2. I think now he feels a little stuck. He's in the 3-2, 2-3 range. And there's this big question, like, is there a path forward for this deck? The core of the combo, okay, you need the Lotus Bloom in the graveyard, you need Temeshi in play, and we want Cultivator as the third piece. Everything else is negotiable, but if you start cutting tutors, what's left of the deck? I mean, I don't think Wargate's a very good card. It is cool how it works.
No, I think Wargate is almost unplayable.
Right. Eladamri's Call is good.
Eladamri's Call is a playable card.
Goblin Engineer is okay. Engineer is like a glorified, unmarked grave, basically. You just want to put the Lotus Bloom in the graveyard. But, you know, we talked about cards like Thraben Inspector or miscellaneous artifacts, even like an artifact land.
Just not being good enough.
Just for the chance to activate Engineer, it just doesn't really come up.
So, before we go to your deck list and how you changed a lot of it, and you actually got some pretty great results with it, let's explain something that we chatted about a bit with Dan, which is like a small process that tends to happen a lot with Bruce, which is like the just... Why am I back to four color midrange? Once you start a brew with multiple colors, this happened similarly to Rob in the Discord a few days ago. I remember his exact comment being like, every single day I look at my deck and it's closer to four color midrange.
It's true.
And it's something that has happened to me remarkably amount of times. You just start changing. You have a specific synergy you really like. You have your Tameshi combo you really enjoy. And all of a sudden, you see it's not quite working. So you take a bit some of the nitpick interaction and just add better cards that work with it. You take out the seals and your Force of Vigor. You take out your Borogate sent you at Brennan's Sixes, you take out your Thriving Spectral at the Ferries, you take out your Esper Sentinel at Expressive Iteration.
Yeah, Omnath is a great way to ramp up to 7 for Cultivator Colossus.
It's just fine, Omnath is a better piece. Why play an Omnath? Basically, if I can play Expressive Iteration to dig. Your brain just starts saying, let's play good cards, Antameshi. And eventually, you get your 5-0 and you look at the deck list and it's 4 color midrange with 4 Tameshi.
Yes.
And you're like, okay, so maybe I should just play 4 color midrange. Because Tameshi is not good, here. And sort of the scenario face, I'm not talking about this specific deck, I'm talking about the concept of sometimes if your synergies are not powerful enough to like earn ourselves a spot, you slowly just start powering up your deck closer to what works. And sometimes you just end up in a position where, yeah, you're playing a better deck, but you're just playing a worse version of another deck, which is, I think, the ultimate brewing scene. Like, it's the one thing I always oppose. If I could play a strictly version, better version of this deck, I really struggle. Even if I enjoy the cards, and I'm not talking like a fun one-off, I'm thinking about conceptually. Like, yeah, if I play, I don't know, what's a card I love? Think Twice in 4-color midrange, it's going to be worse than playing Memory Deluge, but it's not going to be remarkably worse. If I'm playing 4-color Colossus, 4 Tameshi, and an Emrakul in my 4-color midrange deck list, I'm going to feel the pain a bit more.
I mean, if that's a sin, I mean, then I'm the biggest sinner there is.
Oh, no.
I just really philosophically reject that. And I know that I'm in the minority here, but people often tell me, oh, you're just describing a worse version of deck X. And they say that as if that's the end of the argument, as if that's a reason not to do it. And I'm like, well, I don't care. It's going to be different. First of all, what I'm describing is meaningfully different from what you're thinking of as the better version.
Exactly.
Different might be better, might be worse. It's probably worse in the ways you're imagining, but it's still different. And we might find that things you're not thinking of...
It's going to be worse in the average matchup, but you're going to win games because you have a combo. You're going to have a better Tron matchup. It's not strictly worse. Like, that would be insanity. Saying something like that is just insanity. Like, I don't say you shouldn't. I'm just saying I have problems playing it because I just feel like I have to rebuild this. Like, I'm not playing a Tameshi deck. I'm playing Tameshi because I enjoy it. And I just feel like, that's fine. But I didn't get what I wanted out of this.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think that you're describing the Davies dilemma right now as well. I mean, he's been wrestling with this too. Like, should I just put the red and six, the Omnath? Should I get a Solitude in there as an Illidarmer's Call target? Maybe we need Yorion to, like, fit all this stuff in. Because the truth is, you can only get so far with these tutors. I mean, we've spent a lot of time trying to figure out if Finale of Promise is better than Emrakul or not. I actually don't think it is. But
no, I don't think it is. The extra turn is huge.
Like, these things are, like, these are not playable cards. I have not, like, Wargate, Finale of Devastation. Sorry, I think I said the wrong Finale. The green one, Finale of Devastation.
Yeah.
Like, these cards are not modern staples.
No. You look at the deck list and you have the only main deck modern staple cards are, like, Forest per Sentinel, Tuber Double Hole, and we can stretch it into Illidarmer's Call. Like,
yeah, and those are flex slots. I mean, Esper Sentinel doesn't help the combo, really. It's just a value card that Tameshi can get back.
I will even go ahead and say the risky thing. I think even playing Ragavan is better than playing Esper Sentinel, but I'm not ever gonna convince Davies to play Ragavan. No one can. It's impossible. But even then, just having a turn 1 Ragavan into turn 2 Tameshi is like, okay.
So if you had to keep this core, Tameshi, Lotus Bloom, Cultivator Colossus,
okay,
and just try to make it as good as you can, are you saying that you also think you would go in the four-color midrange soup?
That's my problem when I look at this. I'm just like, Card of the Thraven at 4 Ragavan, Card of the Sentinel at Breton 6, leave 8 tutors for Lotus Bloom, like, I would just cut away the Wargate, play the Ferry main deck, maybe trim down a Colossus for an Expressive Iteration, Card of the Mindslayer for another Expressive Iteration, go down to 22 lands with the 4 Brennan 6s. And I would really hastily just say, I'm playing 4-color Omnath with a Tameshi combo in it.
That would probably be an effective deck. I think without that density of Cultivator Colossuses, you might not actually complete the combo. You might just put a Colossus in, draw a bunch of cards, and then pass the turn.
But the thing is, I'm drawing so many good cards in the process. Like, that's the thing. Like, when you fiddle the combo now, you're like, okay, I have 14 mana, 3 Esper Sentinels, 2 Goblin Engineers, 3 damages, and a portable hole in my hand. And well, one of my proposals is, okay, I have 14 mana, a Teferi, a Verdant 6, an Omnath, unlikely, sand remove, and a Ragavan Churash, and maybe a removal spell. Like, if I'm failing, I'm drawing good cards, and I have 14 mana. During my mission fail, we'll get them next time. So I'm actually going to set up a good position in the board to a glorified bag. I'm going to have a Solitude, I'm going to pitch a Fury. That's what I mean. I think the only way to maintain this amount of bad tutors is playing it in a Yorion deck. And even then, it's risky.
Yeah, I've been wondering about that. So I played 2 leagues with a version of Davios' Shell. I went 5-5. And it was not clear to me like how to improve that percentage. And maybe I could have like won an extra match or two if I played a little tighter. But there's just fundamentally, you can't defeat a deck like Is It Murktide or Grixis Shadow that's so efficient when you're trying to play these clunky things.
You are not going to beat the most efficient decks.
That's okay. I mean, 50 to 60% win rate, which is what Davi has had for a while, is really impressive.
100%.
In a format as powerful as Modern, with a brand new deck and with really unseen cards. So I'm rooting for him. I really am.
No, we're always... everyone roots for Davius. You cannot not root for Davius Minimus. It's a mistake. He's like the good guy. Automatically. Like, if you're not rooting for Davius, you're the bad guy.
Exactly. That being said, my next attempt at Temeshi cut all the bad cards. Well, most of the bad cards. Not all of them. We're like, alright, we'll keep Temeshi and we'll try to play just like more reasonable stuff. You mentioned Ragavan as a card that Davius doesn't want to do. He also did not want to play Urza's Saga. And it doesn't really fit in the Cultivator list because losing lands is a little bit tough there. The mana requirements are tough. But Temeshi can return Urza's Saga, and Urza's Saga is like actually good. If Temeshi is a card that just rebuys Urza's Saga a bunch of times, maybe that's good enough. Similarly, Dryad of the Elysian Grove, which is an actually good card. It's a great card, even.
Yeah.
Temeshi rebuys that, so my thought process was, well, maybe I don't need Temeshi to do all this impressive stuff with Lotus Bloom and whatnot. Maybe I just want it to be a supporting player for my good cards. So I've got 4 Urza's Saga, I've got 4 Dryad of the Elysian Grove. What kind of deck uses those cards? And you end up looking at spaces like the Elvish Reclaimer decks that F. Paulus sometimes plays.
Yeah.
There's a black-green Reclaimer Saga deck now that is kind of like a Jund deck. There used to be a green-white, you know, Reclaimer, Dryad, Titania Shell for a while. So I kind of just drew elements from all that together, mashed it up. 28 lands, so I really want my Dryads to be...
That's a lot.
...pretty powerful here. So I've got 4 Dryad, 4 Venom 6, 4 Reclaimer.
Fran will be proud.
Saga.
Exclamation point, Fran, 28 lands.
Exactly. And among my 28 lands, I have 2 Valakut, the Molten Pinnacle. So I'm going to win most of my games, I imagine, with just... Dryad Valakut.
Yeah.
And when I took this into the leagues, I went 4-1, 4-1, and it basically played out as I envisioned. It was actually a pretty solid core. I didn't name all the cards, but, you know, just imagine some supporting cards there. Portable Holes. You have a minor Urza's Saga package. I did want to draw Temeshi reasonably often, so I cut the Explorers from, like, the green and white.
And just have the 4 land call.
Yeah, exactly. Put the tutors in instead. So I had a much slower build, but I had the option to grab Temeshi. I had the option to grab a one of Titania and my one of Zurin Orb, for example. I even put a Slowkirk the Overslime in because I did want to have like at least one pure Temeshi combo available. And the Temeshi combo, which you would not know about unless you listened to our last episode, because people are just like, you know, it's too complicated. But the way it works is you have Seismic Assaults, Dryad of the Elysian Grove, Temeshi, and 2 Urza's Sagas. This forms a loop, and it's like not immediately obvious, but Dryad is there to allow the Urza's Sagas to tap for white mana. That means that they provide the mana instead of Lotus Bloom to basically balance each other, and you're discarding the one you balance to the Seismic Assaults to put it back in the graveyard to go again. So 2 Seismic Assaults in there in the list for that reason. It took me 10 matches to get that to actually come up.
Yeah, that was the common link to my question. So, let's say I wanted to play a Temur or 4-color build of Slowork.
Mm-hmm.
Would you play Temeshi in your Slower deck?
I mean, I thought about it. I thought long and hard about that. I thought about, you know, do I want Goryeo's Vengeance with Slowork and Temeshi? And you know, Hedron crabs can set it all up.
Just leaving the...
Even down all these rabbit holes.
Leaving the over-slime life.
Can get back to Tania.
The over-slime life.
Exactly. I mean, Slowkirk is good now. I mean, we laugh, but Slowkirk is actually pretty good now.
No, I don't laugh about Slowkirk. I love Slowkirk. I just think the over-slime is the best title they have ever put on a Magikarp. But I'm actually trying to make Slowkirk work again in like the Forgotten Mirror Shell because I just love that. I love the card. I just love that when it leaves the battlefield, it's a 3/4/1 theoretically, like it's never bad. And it makes Mosesu cost 1, which is just so fun. Like the fact it just reduces the cost of Mosesu because it's legendary is just like the perfect combo on its own.
Yeah, I mean, like, we're not really talking about Temeshi at this point, but I had these cards in my deck. Casting a 1-mana Baseju off Slowkirk was amazing. Using Baseju with Renin 6 was just amazing. It won me a bunch of games.
So, we refire this deck, we change Temeshi for Slowkirk and see what happens.
I honestly think that I would leave one Temeshi in as a tutor target.
Exactly. Like, we change them.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
We just go 4-1 instead.
Yeah, I mean, that could be...
And I think that could be better. Like, you have the Temeshi for the combo, you have the Slowkirk for the fair plan, because... In this deck, when we're playing a fair game, I think like Slowkirk, because Slowkirk also gets back Ursa Saga, which is something that has, I think no one has ever done yet, like an Ursa Saga Slowkirk deck, like the Demur lands tend to just focus on like the spell lands and such and cycle lands, because you're playing Timur, and who would play Timur with Ursa Saga, right Dan? Who would play 4-color with Ursa Saga and a triple red spell? Who would do that?
There's not that many players pairing Urza Saga with Renin 6 right now.
No, not at all.
I mean, it's tough. Like, it's kind of awkward. You just, like, if you want to play Ren on turn 2, you cannot play Saga until turn 3. And this is where the Dryad is so important. Like, the Dryad allowing you to double land drop on turn 3. Like, it's by far the best card in the deck, Dryad of the Elysian Grove.
Oh, yeah. In order to consider Renin 6, like, an extra land, you will need to have, like, at least 22 lands that can cast it. And then you have the 4 sagas, which don't count towards that, so we need to go to at least, like, 26 lands in order to consistently cast your Renin 6 on curve. Or just play those two colors. Be, like, Gruul or Shun at most.
So, I like this deck. It had 4 Temeshis. It shouldn't have had 4 Temeshis, and I knew that going in. I just wanted to give it a chance.
But you got double 4 once.
Temeshi was like plan... what is plans? What comes after plan C? It's like plan E. It's like the fifth plan. After your first 4 things, which are actually good cards.
After you play your Reclaimer as ramp, after the Renin 6 gets resolved, after you lose your Dryad and Balagut, after they bolt your Titania before you get your Sudan Orb, there you go for the Temeshi kill. That's a sweet spot.
And that happened a few times. I mean, like, it's actually a devastating card to have in play. As just a value engine, it draws you... A
card extra per turn, at least.
It draws a card and returns a card, so it's +2 cards just for spending mana. Yeah. It's actually extremely good. But that scenario comes up late and seldom.
And it's like, it's a 3-mana 2/3 that has to survive.
Well, I mean... Does it have to survive? It doesn't have to survive.
No.
I mean, you get one activation.
You get one activation because you have a lot of mana, you're right.
Like, you just cast it. As long as you have one white, you can return an Urza Saga, and that's a +2 card advantage for you.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and that's, I think, the strong part about Temeshi. I think also the best screenshot is I won this game by Seismic Assaulting my own 7/7 to protect it from X equal 29 March of Forge Sorrow.
Yes, there's like a Cabal Coffers deck going around.
Yes.
Or at least there was during the week I was playing this.
No, Trelon is the one leading the charge in there, playing a Sultai Black Coffers, mono black with Hydroclastis deck.
So they sit behind Karn and Ensnaring Bridge for a while and just build up a bunch of stuff. They Sundering Titan me twice in the game, but I had a Slowkirk in play, so my Slowkirk just grew to like 20/20. This is why I had this ridiculous finish where I eventually found like something to kill the bridge. So I had a lot of stuff, like Wasager and whatnot. And then at that point, I was ready to attack. They had a million mana from all their coffers. It was just nonsense.
That's just the random nonsense I lean for, and she insults me for leaving for.
Yeah.
Also, your next hand, that's like Seismic Assault, and for non-red lands in hand, is just a piece of art.
It's extremely hard to cast Seismic Assault.
It's extremely hard to cast Seismic Assault.
It was like much better to discard it to hand size and then get it back later with Temeshi.
No, stop. Stop. The phrase "discard into hand size" has not once in modern history be a good start to any concept. Not once in modern history the phrase "discard to hand size" has led to something good. Unless you're finishing the sentence with that, it's like, no, I was winning, I was already discarding to hand size. Full stop, dot, I was winning because I had so many cards. If your phrase starts with, oh, okay, so we first discard to hand size, we're not going to where we want to be heading.
Yeah. All right, so let me just gather my final thoughts on what I learned about Temeshi specifically from this deck. So it is a good supporting card. It's actually a pretty good fair card. It works amazingly well with Dryad of the Elysian Grove and Valakut. Dryad, outside of like the Amulet bounce lands, sometimes you risk running out of land drops with Dryad of the Elysian Grove, but Temeshi, because it bounces your own lands, it does some pretty cool stuff, just like giving you extra land drops. I mentioned that it gets Dryad back, it gets Urza's Saga back, so I do think that there is like a path forward for Temeshi just with the Dryad Valakut kill. And I think that, you know, if I had to like just give Davies my best advice, it would be just stop trying to put finishers in the deck and just play Dryad Valakut instead with a higher land count. And like, you will actually probably just win more that way. Cultivator Colossus can win off that.
Remove the Emrakul and just focus on having a secondary game plan.
Yeah, like cut the War Gates, cut the Finale of Devastations, and just, you know, play lands, Dryads. And Temeshi is just good with those cards. You won't combo as often, but you might find yourself just winning more. You know, Temeshi is good at land drops, Cultivator is good at land drops, and Dryad Valakut is very good at land drops. Focus on that. I noticed the player Spike Yu, who's up there on the trophy leaderboard right now, took a version of Temeshi to a 4-1. It had some of the same ideas, right? Try to cut the bad cards, you end up with basically just Amulet Titan, with like a brief Temeshi Lotus Bloom package wedged in there, and they were actually splashing black for Persistent Unmarked Grave.
Okay.
The idea being that Unmarked Grave duplicates the Goblin Engineer effect, so when you need it to find Lotus Bloom, you can. But when you don't have that, you can just find a Primeval Titan and then maybe persist that back.
Is it better than... Maybe that's a good... Like, if you want to go full on the combo, maybe that's better than Engineer. Like, just have that set up as a plan B.
Maybe. I mean, it's weird because... So Unmarked Grave can't find Legendary Permanence, so it can't find Temeshi. It can find Colossus and Lotus Bloom, so it's like sort of okay. Persist can't get back Temeshi, but it can get back, you know, if you want to play Primetime or something else strong like that, you can. I haven't like figured out exactly how I would build this version. Spike, you did have to go up to 80 cards just to fit this all in, so this is an 80 card Yorian deck with no Yorian synergies whatsoever, but that's fine.
Yeah, it's like the less Yorian deck.
Other concepts, I'll just name a couple that I've seen bouncing around the web or around Temeshi Discord. So there is an alternate path that does not involve Cultivator Colossus at all. We talked about this last week. So Aurelax, Dom Harvey were very excited about Amulet of Vigor with the tapped bridges from MH2. And like maybe that is your loop with Temeshi instead. So similar to how I said Dryad plus Urza's Saga provides white mana for a loop. You could do the same thing with Amulet and Bridges and some discard outlets, in this case, Artificer's Intuition. You can't do it online. This is the problem. It takes... How many clicks does it take, Emmy, to like activate Temeshi once?
No, it was like 2 billion. No, activate Temeshi 1 is 5, I think. Click on Temeshi, click on the discard. Yeah, that's...
You have to click on the mana and then click OK. It's like just so many clicks just to activate Temeshi once, and then if you have to add in anything else, any other triggers, it's just a nightmare.
The thing is, with the Lotus Bloom, you don't have to do it that many times, because it's like 20 times at most for the whole combo.
Yeah, the Lotus Bloom combo is doable. I think anything with Amulet and Artificer's Intuition is out of the question online. But there is the option to play in paper. There's a player named Underworld Faith in the Temeshi Discord. Took a blue-white build with artifacts with that Amulet package to a 3-1. I've been interested in some kind of Sculpting Steel combo with Darksteel Citadel, and I describe all this in last week's show if you want to see how all that works. You can graft in some other combo there, like Sherim the Hegemon. You have Goryeo's Vengeance and Jace Fringe Prodigy.
Just going all in.
I'm not going to spend too much time on these yet because I haven't tested them, but I will put the links in the episode description, and I invite anyone who just wants to see some wild ideas being thrown around. You can always ping me or come join us in the Faithless Brewing Discord. We'd love to have you there and chat with these wild concepts.
I think that I just got a shot just to see what's being spewed around. Like, just because of Chaos and Bound. Also, I really don't like the Mind Slaver in the Dameshi combo.
Yeah, you can cut that. Yeah. You can for sure cut that. I mean, there's so many flex slots. It's a three-card combo with a bunch of tutors and flex slots.
Yeah, I think it's trying to go everything to rule of 12. I think everything is on rule of 12 in the deck, which is pretty interesting. Sadly, it's Sambat 12s.
Yeah. All right, maybe we should leave it here. Let's bring it all together. What have we learned? I mean, like, what do you see as the future for this card?
So I think Dameshi is gonna... I think Dameshi has the power to be an extremely powerful mid-range sort of value additive card. Like, one sort of like Lurrus, like, you know, without the companion part, but we have seen Lurrus on the main deck. It's one of those cards that if you let survive, it's gonna win the game. It's gonna take a hold of the game, slowly give you more and more card advantage until you just cannot keep up with it. It's also an advantage that you can play that sort of card in a combo way, which is like really pumping it up even more. The only problem I have with it is how it just goes against whatever you could be doing. Like, sadly, you're making value, you're adding value, but you're also losing land drops, which is what you want to do in a value deck, because you just need the mana to play what you draw. What if I'm drawing 10 cards, but I have 4 lands, I'm just playing the same card that I would be playing otherwise. So that conflicting stuff means you need extra ways of mana acceleration, or maybe you just bounce a land, get something back like Utopias, probably Rusa Saga to keep up on mana while drawing a card. It's a sort of strange simile you have in the problem with it. I think Dameshi is not a bad card at all. I just think the current shells sadly try to ask too much of it. Like, just look at Davis Minimus decklist, you're seeing 8 one drops that have barely any text, 10 tutors, and a castable 7 drop if you're not comboing. And for Dameshi's. Like, the whole game is on the back of Dameshi carrying that game single-handedly. So maybe we're not getting a real glimpse of its power, because when it doesn't do that, it's disappointing, because it's just supposed to actually win. And I like it a lot more in, like, your decklist, when you're actually just trying to play a fair plan mostly, but you have an additional combo, even if it only happened 1 out of 10 times.
It happened 1 out of 10 times, and I also had Velikut in play, so I didn't even need the combo,
So it's a matter of seeing.
I mean, I think I wasn't asking enough from Dameshi. There's got to be a middle ground.
Exactly, that's what I mean.
You've got to meet somewhere in the middle.
I think we're asking more for Slogork than Dameshi, but we just wanted to play Dameshi.
Yeah, I do think the path forward involves Dryad and Velikut, because Dryad solves that land drop problem. Dryad allows Dameshi to be a good value engine without setting you too far behind.
Maybe that's the way. Maybe it's having Lotus Bloom. Maybe it's having Dameshi. Maybe it's having some number of Cultivar Colossus, just not playing for Thraven Inspector, for Goblin Engineer, for Wargates, and just playing the good card. Maybe just play the good cards has been a phrase thrown around on Twitter, and maybe it's sort of where we should be heading.
Exactly. Well, I don't know what the future holds, but I'm excited to see
where it leads us.
I'm sure I'll be testing this some more. That being said, I think we're going to call it here for today. Emmy, I will bid you farewell.
Bye-bye. Thanks so much, then. Hope you have a nice day.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
That's a wrap on this edition of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Tune in next week for our testing results and download the latest deck lists at faithlessbrewing.com. Support for this podcast is provided by brewers like you. If you like what we do, you can join our community at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing for Discord access, bonus content, and more. That's all for today. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.